Welcome to the Upward Running Podcast, where faith fuels your fitness journey.
Welcome back to the Upward Running Podcast. You know, last year, I decided that I was going to pick out my 10 favorite Dean's thoughts that I wrote for the year, and I was going to share those in a podcast. And I decided I was going to do the same thing again this year. So we are going to share the top 10 Dean's thoughts from this year. And we're going to start off with number 10 with a story by the name of shelf space. You know, many of us, we access these negative things in our brain like very quickly. Like that's the first thing that comes to mind are these negative things. But my contention is we need to rearrange our brains so that we have quick access to the good things. And that's what this story is about. It's called shelf space. Have you ever seen one of those messages that says your storage is full? Maybe it came through your computer to inform you that you can't do that thing you want to do because there's insufficient memory. Or perhaps you've tried to take a photograph only to get the notification that your phone storage is full and there is no room for another photo. 90% of us have, in all likelihood, seen that message. Now think about your brain. How does your brain work? Well, I submit that it works a lot like a computer. There is only so much space in there for things. Admittedly, some people seem to have much larger hard drives than others, and still others can access that information much faster, but we all have limits. Now think of a grocery store. Like a computer and your brain, there is limited space. A store cannot carry every item available due to limited shelf space, and some of that shelf space is more valuable than others. To be sure, there are big fights over where items are displayed, eye level being the ideal height. Now back to your brain. You have a limited shelf space in your brain, and some of the information in there is easier to see than others. When you're obsessed with negative thoughts, it's because you have placed those thoughts at eye level on an end cap. You have placed them in the most prominent location. You almost can't help seeing them, like the party items just before the Super Bowl. I think we need to rearrange our shelves. It's almost impossible to stop yourself from having negative thoughts, but if you must have them, you can place them in the back of the store, in the corner, and on the bottom shelf. Then, on those end caps and point of purchase displays, you should place the most positive thoughts you can imagine. Spend some time on those thoughts too, making the display as bright and as inviting as you can. You want the good thoughts to be the first thing you see. And if you keep adding those good thoughts, maybe you'll eventually run out of storage space for those negative thoughts. Do you think about negative or positive thoughts when you run or walk? When it gets hard, is your first thought, "Oh, this is so miserable"? Or is it, "Let me focus on a Bible verse or a song to get me through this run"? You have a default position usually, and that default is based on where you put those thoughts in your grocery store brain. The thing is that you usually know the right thoughts to think. That means those thoughts are on the shelves of your grocery store brain, but they're buried in the back where you only go to look when you have time. When you're working hard and there is stress on your body, you don't have time to go pleasure shopping. You need to grab those good thoughts and get on with your business. Philippians 4:8 says, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." What Paul is writing here is that it's not enough to not think bad thoughts. We need to crowd out those bad thoughts with good thoughts. He is saying, fill up your grocery store brain with so much good stuff that you don't even have room for the bad stuff. And if you think your circumstances are too tough to think positive thoughts, consider that Paul was in prison while he wrote those words. If you struggle with negative thinking, maybe you need to clear out your shelves and restock them in an entirely different way. Reading Philippians 4:8 over and over might be a good start. Find the most positive things you can think up and put them right inside the front door. With all the good news contained in the Bible, it seems to me there is no reason to even stock anything else. Coming in at number 9, maybe my favorite title, the documentary effect. You know, the documentary effect tells us that anytime we're only presented with the most persuasive evidence for one side, well, then we tend to believe that side. But what about the other side? The chances are that you believe things that are not true today because of the documentary effect. So, what are the implications of the documentary effect on our running? Well, let me share that with you here as we listen to the documentary effect. As a college coach, there were many times when our team was traveling to a competition or home from competition when we needed to stop to get a bite to eat. I'm not picky about what I eat when others are around, and I aimed to keep my athletes happy, so I'd ask them where they wanted to stop and eat. I found their answers interesting. Almost all of them would be happy to stop at Chick-fil-A or Zaxby's. Some of them liked Cookout or other fast food burger places. But one thing was certain. We could never stop at McDonald's. In my years as coach, we never stopped at McDonald's. The question is, why? I was told in no uncertain terms several times that McDonald's food is really bad for you. A trip to McDonald's, it seemed, was roughly equivalent to smoking a pack of cigarettes. You may feel the same way, but I'm about to tell you, you are mistaken. Cartoonist Scott Adams calls it the documentary effect. When you watch a documentary, the idea behind it is to present one side of a story or idea. Sometimes those films take up a supporting or opposing view of a subject. For example, I remember a documentary in the 1980s about Bigfoot. After watching it, you would be convinced that he exists. Now, 40 years later, with cell phones in every pocket, we have no evidence for his existence. Yet, there are still people today who think he's out there just waiting to be discovered. Sorry to break it to you. It's not going to happen. Getting back to my original story, a man named Morgan Spurlock made a documentary called Supersize Me. In the film, he ate McDonald's food and nothing but McDonald's food for a full month to see what would happen. It showed that his health took a devastating turn, and the film seemed to indicate that he would have died if he would have stayed on that diet any longer. Suffice it to say that there have been many debunks of the film, including other films where people did the same thing. So what's my point, you ask? The documentary effect tells us that anytime we are only presented one side of the most persuasive evidence for something, we tend to believe it. The movie Supersize Me and the ensuing press coverage made it fashionable for health-conscious people to think McDonald's was the unhealthiest fast food restaurant on the planet. Now, I'm not here to defend McDonald's as a healthy place to eat, but I am here to say that it is an average fast food joint. Just because Zaxby's is serving chicken instead of beef does not make it healthy. Again, I'm sorry to burst anyone's bubble. So why does it even matter? Well, I'm glad you asked. When you run, your brain is constantly feeding you information. And the harder you run, the more dire that information becomes. When you're trying to push yourself as hard as you can, your brain is telling you to stop. It's a constant battle. Your brain is acting like a documentary. It is only feeding you one side of the story. Oh, it'll give you both sides of the story on an easy run. But when you're trying to push your body to the limit, you're only getting the negative side of the story. You're getting the supersize me side of the story. Don't listen to it. Instead, if you want to know why the Supersize Me documentary is exaggerated storytelling, just type Supersize Me debunk into a search engine to get the other side of the story. Again, I'm not advocating for eating at McDonald's for 30 days straight, but I also wouldn't eat at any fast food joint for 30 days straight. Now, when you're in the middle of pushing yourself as hard as you can, type into your personal search engine, I'm dying debunk. If you're honest and you really want to push yourself to the limit, you'll get back something like, you can do it, just keep pushing. Don't listen to one side, get the full picture. When it comes to faith, we have to understand that the world has seen too many crazy Christian documentaries. It's not their fault that they think like they do. They were persuaded by the documentary. But we have the truth. And that truth, when presented to someone who wants to listen, can change the life of the former non-believer. Just ask J. Warner Wallace, who wrote a book called Cold Case Christianity. He looked for the forensic truth and found it. Anyone looking in earnest will find it. We just have to get people to the point of wanting to type into the search engine, Atheism Debunk. No matter what the subject is, beware the documentary effect. I know it is not fashionable in today's world to get both sides of anything, even our news, but you'll be far better off if you do. And help those who have only heard the wrong side of the Jesus story. Their lives are depending on it.
Man, that's a good one, Dean.
Coming in at number 8 is a story called Swatting Away the Gnats. I used to live in South Georgia, and the gnats were terrible down there, right? They're famous for how bad the gnats are down there. So how is running like a bunch of gnats flying around your face? Well, I'm going to tell you in this one, and I'm going to tell you what you can do about it in Swatting Away the Gnats. South Georgia is famous for pine trees, azaleas, and peanuts. If you're a golf fan, you know how beautiful it can be to watch the Masters tournament that takes place just a little north of what I consider South Georgia. And most people know that President Jimmy Carter was from the heart of South Georgia, Plains, where the peanut is king. But that area of the country is known for something not so positive, too. Gnats. Somewhere around the middle of Georgia lies what we call the gnat line. At one time, I lived less than an hour from the Georgia-Florida line, so I'm very familiar with these pesky insects. Sometime around the transition from spring to summer, they show up for a month or so and drive us crazy. They fly around your head, land on your face, and sometimes even make their way into your mouth if you're not careful. And there's a gazillion of them. Pesky is a good description, but somehow falls short of just how irritating these creatures are. People who are not from South Georgia have a tough time with them, but many people who live there seem to handle them with no problem. They seem to not even notice that they're flying around their face. Why? Because they know that if they let the nuisance win, it will drive them crazy. So they ignore the bugs. If you're not from that part of the country, it is hard to understand how they do it. Now, you may ask, why in the world are you talking about bugs? Well, like so many other things in life, I think we can learn something from the way South Georgians react to those irritating monsters we call gnats. The uneasiness that comes from running is a little like those gnats. It is irritating, annoying, frustrating, even infuriating to deal with those little insects. Well, doesn't each of those words also describe the discomfort of a run? I think it does. So what can we learn from how the South Georgians deal with gnats that we can apply to our running discomfort? Well, first of all, it's important to realize that just because some people have the ability to tune out those pesky creatures doesn't mean they're not still there. The bugs are flying around their face just like yours, but they're choosing to react differently to them. They know there's nothing they can do to dissuade them from what they're doing. They swat at them all they want, but it will be to no avail. In other words, it is a waste of time and effort to do so. Once you accept that there is nothing you can do about them, you're halfway to being able to ignore them. The same goes for our running discomfort. It is going to be there, and there's nothing you can do to change it. Accept it, and you are halfway to being able to ignore it. Second, you can choose to stay indoors and mostly avoid being around gnats, but that is a terrible choice for your well-being. You need to do outdoor things, if for no other reason than you need vitamin D. Nobody who stays indoor all the time is living their best life, period. You need to go outside. The same goes for exercise in general and for running more specifically. You can choose not to do it, but you won't be living your best life if you're a couch potato. Finally, being able to look past an irritant like a gnat makes it easier to look past many other irritants. Being able to look past the discomfort of a run makes it easier to look past other things that are uncomfortable. By being able to look past the things that get in our way, we are able to follow through on things we want to accomplish. If we let the gnats bother us, it takes our focus off whatever else we're doing. If we let the discomfort from a run control us, then we miss the full benefit of that run. And that carries over into how we deal with that coworker who doesn't seem to like us, or the traffic we will inevitably face during rush hour. Nehemiah had to swat some gnats away when he was busy rebuilding the wall in Jerusalem. Nehemiah 6:1 through 3 says, "But they thought to do me harm, so I sent messengers to them, saying, 'I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it to go down to you?'" The world is full of distractions, many of them directed by the one who wants to keep us from doing God's will. Nehemiah swatted away the gnats and kept working on God's plan. What a great example of who God wants us to be, focused on carrying out His will for our lives. Don't let a little discomfort during a run derail you. Learn to overcome it by pushing it to the back of your mind and treating it like the South Georgians treat the gnats. And don't let the evil one knock you off track with his distractions. Stay on the work God has put in front of you. Swat away any gnats that get in your way and keep going.
That's a great story, Dean. Okay, I argue that the gnat line has moved north over the years.
You think?
Because gnats are horrible around here.
My number 7 story from last year is a story called Going to Siberia. Siberia is famously cold and brutal, the weather there. So what can we learn from the old Soviet cosmonauts who trained in Siberia to go to space? Now, why would they do that? Well, I'm going to share that in this story. And listen to this one as I talk about us going to Siberia. We've all heard many incredible stories about the Apollo missions and how our United States astronauts performed amazing tasks under great pressure. The Apollo missions grew more and more complex with each launch, in large part inspired by our race to space and ultimately the race to the moon with the Soviet Union. We may have gotten to the moon eventually, even without the Soviet competition, but it was certainly hastened by our desire to be first. Just like there are interesting stories about our astronauts, there are interesting stories about the Soviet cosmonauts as well. We can learn a lot, for example, from the Soviet response to their first mission that included more than one cosmonaut. Even though they had spent many training hours developing the best individual cosmonauts they knew how, they found that when they put them together, they didn't get along, and when placed under duress, they didn't perform well in groups. So what did they do in response? They sent them to Siberia. It is famously cold in Siberia. Cosmonauts were subjected to minus 40 degree cold with wind chills up to minus 60. They were forced to endure horrible conditions, and then they were given tasks to do as a group. The men who worked well under duress were the most successful of the groups, and those were the men who were chosen for future missions. When we run hard, our body is under duress. It can be difficult to think clearly. We can be irritable. Consequently, we make bad decisions. So, of course, we need to go to Siberia. No, I'm not talking about the actual place where the weather is brutal, but we can go there in our training. When we're on those last 400s at the end of a 16 by 400 workout, we're going to Siberia. When we're struggling up the last of our 20 hill repeats, we're in Siberia. When we're trying our best to run as hard as we can, we're running in Siberia. And doesn't that sound hardcore? If we wish to get the most out of ourselves, or even just to consistently pull off our workouts, we need to make the mental move to Siberia. One of the toughest barriers we face is the barrier of ease. It is the fact that sitting on the couch and binging episodes of Seventh Street Theater is much easier. It is the fact that it's hot outside and our air conditioning feels way too good. It is the fact that running when tired is just plain hard. Go to Siberia, at least in your mind. If you can get your mind to accept that Siberia holds the keys to a better life, a fitter life, a more complete life, a life where our every interaction is richer and fuller, you can make it through the discomfort. And the truth is that for most of us, it is a mild winter in Siberia. And for those of us who must face the full force of Siberia, it is worth it. Matthew 16:24 and following says, "Then Jesus told his disciples, 'If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul?'" That is not a life of ease, but it is a fuller, richer life, a life worth living. So what are you going to do? Are you going to sit on the comfortable couch in your comfortable air conditioning where you think you're living your best life? Are you going to travel to Siberia where you face bitter cold and some tough times in exchange for your actual best life? The choice is yours. Few people make the trek to space, but you can do it if you're willing to endure a little tough weather. And it may sound like picking up your cross daily is a tough life, and in many ways it is. But when you can feel God all around you because you have made that sacrifice, there is no better feeling this side of heaven. You know, I've always been a big baseball fan, and the story at number 6 illustrates the baseball fan, why I'm a baseball fan, right? Did you know that in the big leagues, the home plate is 17 inches wide? Well, do you know how wide it is for the little leagues? Well, you're going to have to keep listening to this story to find out the answer to that and then how it applies to us as runners and walkers. This one's called 17 Inches. I have always loved baseball. I played when I was young, watched the Braves nearly every night for years, and Debbie and I have traveled to 25 different major league ballparks. In addition, I have also spent a lot of time at local ball fields, both as a coach and as a spectator. Baseball and I go way back. Here's a trivia question for you. Do you know how wide home plate is for a t-ball game? It's 17 inches. Do you know how wide it is for a high school game? It's 17 inches. How about a college game? Still 17 inches. How about Major League Baseball? That's right. The major leaguers play with a home plate that is the exact same dimensions as a t-baller. In addition, every home plate on the planet is white with a black border around it. There are also some artificial fields with home plate painted onto the turf. What color is it? White. Home plate is white and 17 inches wide every time. It is the standard. The distance between bases ranges from 60 feet to 90 feet. The baseball varies slightly in circumference and weight. The distance to the pitcher's rubber varies too. But home plate? It's 17 inches wide. Every time. Everywhere. Running and walking are a little like a baseball field. There are different size runners and they run at different speeds. But the idea is to put one foot in front of the other. Every time. We can fret about how hard it is to get out the door, but we're fretting about simply putting one foot in front of the other. Why complicate things? We can get so nervous when we can get so nervous we feel like we're going to get sick when we step to the line for a race. But it is simply one foot in front of the other. Why do we tie ourselves up in knots over something so simple? We can and should worry about our nutrition as we fuel our bodies for our activities, but it's still just one foot in front of the other. No matter how we try to complicate the simple act of running and or walking, at the end of the day, there are not many things that are more rudimentary than one foot in front of the other. Remember that the next time you're struggling. One foot in front of the other is standard procedure, just like 17 inches is the standard for home plate. Whether you're a year old and just learning to walk, or you're 80 and trying to continue to walk, it is one foot in front of the other. Whether you are a stay-at-home mom trying to stay in shape, or a college athlete trying to qualify for a national championship, it is one foot in front of the other. There are a lot of denominations in our world today. I go to a Baptist church, but I've also been to Methodist churches, Churches of God, Churches of Christ, Nazarene churches, Catholic churches, and many others. The bottom line is, who is Jesus? Although there are many doctrinal and liturgical questions about each of these organizations, it is the question of the person of Jesus that matters most. Period. Jesus is Lord and Savior. Period. We have standards in every area of our lives. In baseball, home plate is always 17 inches wide. In running, it is always as simple as one foot in front of the other. And in our faith, Jesus is Emmanuel, Lord with us. If you're trying to complicate things, take a step back and look at the standard. When you go back to basics and put things in perspective, the next step is usually pretty well defined. If you're struggling to go run, it really is simple. Go do it. If you're struggling with your faith, what are you doing with Jesus? That is what matters.
The simplest answer is most often the correct answer.
You know, it was a risky move to move into such controversial territory as returning your shopping cart to the shop, to the corral, right? This one's called Shopping Carts and Running. That's scary, right? That's such a controversial subject over whether we should return our shopping carts or is it a terrible thing if we don't. Well, you're going to learn my thoughts on that when you go through this story. And this one is called Shopping Carts and Running.
So we're going to get canceled here.
Maybe.
I have a feeling.
We try to stay away from controversy. But I'm going to head straight for one of the most controversial subjects on the planet. This one is called Shopping Carts and Running. I try not to comment on current cultural things, but something caught my eye, and I think it's relevant to both our fitness journey and our faith journey. It's a very sensitive subject, so let me apologize up front if I step on any toes here. The incredibly touchy subject I'm talking about, of course, is returning your shopping cart to the cart corral. I know what you're thinking. Dean, you've written well over 300 Dean's Thoughts without wading into such controversial territory. Why start now? Well, let me just say, I know, but it's such a good illustration that I just can't help myself. There are four categories of shopping cart users. One, those who always return their cart because they view it as their duty to do so. Two, those who return the cart when it's convenient, but not if it's going to take any real extra effort. Three, those who will return their cart if they think someone is looking and will think less of them if they don't. And then four, those who never return their cart under any circumstances because they believe it is the store's responsibility. Of course, if you're in any category other than the first one, you are contributing to the downfall of civilization. If we reach a tipping point and too many people migrate out of the responsible category, a Mad Max scenario is surely right around the corner. There are many excuses for not returning your shopping cart. The corral is too far away. My foot hurts. It's raining. Or it's too cold. Or it's too hot. I don't want to leave my children unattended. Or my personal favorite, I'm leaving it here for the next person. And there are a thousand of other alleged reasons for people to shirk their clear responsibility to hold civilization together. But none of them are good. Now, to be clear, I have left a shopping cart outside of its designated place. I'm no angel, but I haven't done it in a long time. As a matter of fact, I often try to make up for others by taking a couple of carts back into the store from the parking lot when I arrive. I figure I'm going that way anyway. So you can see that I am serious about shopping cart management. The question is, why? I think the shopping cart dilemma is very similar to both our fitness and faith journeys. Why is it hard to get out and keep yourself fit through running and or walking? Well, it's for the same reason that we don't return our shopping carts. It's not convenient enough. It's too hot. I don't have time. There are a thousand reasons why people don't keep themselves fit. And like the shopping cart thing, none of them are really good excuses. Will it take effort? Yes. Just like returning the shopping cart. You can make excuses or you can just get out there and get it done. Now, unlike returning shopping carts, there are times when you can't run, an injury, for example. But make sure you're not using an excuse that sounds good on the surface, but is really not a good excuse. The one we hear all the time with shopping carts is, I don't want to leave my child in the car unattended while I return the cart. On the surface, it sounds great. I care about my child. Seems like a good reason. But we have key fobs that allow us to lock and unlock our car in an instant if we're really concerned. All I'm saying is that we should make every effort to return our cart, and we should make every effort to get our workouts in. If it doesn't happen due to circumstances we could not overcome, fine. But make sure the circumstances really are that dire before giving up because it's hot outside today. We're pretty good at excuses for our lack of time with God, too. I'm too busy. I can't find a church I like. I don't know how to pray. And my personal favorite, there are too many hypocrites in church. God wants to spend time with us, both at church and in our personal lives. There are many ways to do it, and there are even more ways to avoid it. If you have a tough time finding time for God, what are your reasons? Are you making plausible-sounding excuses but getting little time with God? If so, you might want to take a step back from those excuses and find a way, even if it's hard. We tend to over-dramatize things. For some of us, it's making excuses to skip a workout. For others, it's allowing yourself to be burdened by the complexity of life and missing your time with God. I've run every day but one for almost 13 years. I know there's a way to find time to do the things you want to do. And I'm convinced that no matter how busy life is, you can too. What do you think? Too controversial?
I think that's one of your best ones.
Yeah?
Good job, Dean. Yeah, very good. Yeah, I mean, it's so... I would have never thought of that analogy, but it's... Man, it's spot on.
My number four Dean's thoughts from last year is a story called Comfort Crisis. My contention is that we are too comfortable, and I think we'd be better off if we purposefully made ourselves less comfortable sometimes, and that's what I talk about in this story coming in at number four called The Comfort Crisis. I was born at a time when things were different. It would take a fortnight to list all the things that have changed, so I won't go over many of them, but let's take a couple of simple examples. I remember having to get up out of my seat to change the channel on the television. There was no such thing as a remote control for our enormous 27-inch televisions. It's a simple thing, but when you multiply that one issue times 1,000 other things that are much easier today, it has a substantial impact on the amount of activity we employ today versus 40 years ago. It has impacted our fitness, I'd say. At that same time, I also remember having to go to the library to do research. I write a Dean's Thought story every week, and I never have to leave my chair because all the information we need is at our fingertips or can even be accessed by just speaking words. We should be smarter than ever as a society, but we're not. For the first time in history, the average IQ of a person has decreased over the past decade or so. It seems that the close access to all the information at any moment in time has decreased our desire to learn new things. After all, if I can find the answer to any question in 20 seconds, why should I retain any information? So what gives? Why are we headed in a direction of poorer general fitness and becoming less educated? It may surprise you that I have a hypothesis. I think we are in a comfort crisis. What an oxymoronic phrase, right? Comfort crisis. Comfort is a good thing, isn't it? We've worked hard for thousands of years to get to a place where we can tap on our phones a few times and dinner shows up at the door. After all that work, is it now a crisis? Well, I think it is anyway. Here's the crux of the problem. There was a time when one of the most desired attributes was the appreciation of achieving hard things. But today, we lean toward the exact opposite. We love the things that make our lives easier more than we love those achievements. Nobody did it on purpose. We're just naturally inclined toward comfort. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we should still be more impressed with the friend who finished a marathon than the friend who just purchased a robot to clean her floors. The good news is that there is a simple fix. Do hard things. And learn about them at the same time. Run that 5K you don't think you can run. And learn about the term VO2 max. Finish that marathon that even your friends think you can't do and get acquainted with the dreaded wall. Find something hard, something worthwhile. Learn about it and do it. And when you see or hear about someone else doing a hard thing, take notice. Cheer them on. Let them know it inspired you. Maybe we can change this underappreciation for accomplishing hard things. We're even willing to do our part to help you get there if you're willing to embrace the struggle. You have to be willing to exchange a little comfort for a little discomfort. We've heard a few stories over the years where people compare their running struggles with the pain of Jesus going to the cross. Of course, the comparison is absurd, as it is meant to be in those stories. Our sacrifice and discomfort to accomplish any goal will never be as difficult as what our Savior did for us on the cross. He willingly accepted a journey he did not want. He prayed in the garden, "Take this from me." He did not want to suffer and go to the cross, but he continued in his prayer, "Nevertheless, your will be done." God had a hard job for him, and he did it. And we have salvation because of that decision, that attitude, and ultimately the carrying through with the hardest thing anyone has ever done. Comfort is a good thing. I like being comfortable. Being able to use Google is not bad, but we need to yearn for a deeper learning too. The truth is that deeper satisfaction comes from accomplishment and from real knowledge. There is no accomplishment in comfort and complacency. You must go against the grain. The world embraces easier, but there is much more value in bucking that trend. Beat the comfort crisis by fully embracing something hard today.
It's a great story, Dean. So true.
We sound like a broken record, I guess. When we were in Mississippi last year at the Mississippi River Marathon, I came up with this idea for this story called "Did the Coach See That?" You know, I often hear people say, if I only had someone to help me do that hard thing, whether it's dieting or running or whatever it is, then I would do it if I only had somebody to help push me to do that. Well, let me ask you this. Why do you need any more help than from God? He sees everything we do, and the Bible says we should do all to the glory of God. And shouldn't that be motivation enough? This one's called, "Did the Coach See That?" As I ran the last couple of miles of the Mississippi River Marathon, I passed a few of our Run for God half marathon participants. The two races followed the same race course, with the marathon starting further out. It was a great mental boost over those grueling final miles of a marathon to see and hear people I know cheering me on. After the race was over, one of the Run for God folks said, "It was my job to make sure that we were not walking when the coach approached us before the end of the race. I kept looking behind me, but he snuck up on us while we were walking anyway." They were in a group, mostly running, but they took a walking break, and I ran up on them when they did. Of course, in this example, they were only joking about when the lookout said, "I had one job." But it made me think, when I was a kid, there were things I would not do when my parents were watching me. Why? Because I knew they were things I shouldn't be doing. How would my behavior have changed if they were always watching me? I remember when I was in high school, when Randy Ashley and I ran together for a 6-miler one day. Randy was a freshman and I was a sophomore. We had a great run, but when we returned to school, we found out that nobody else completed the run. They all decided it was the one day they would hide in the woods to avoid doing what the coach had asked us to do. Randy and I were the only ones who ran. I remember thinking, "Coach is not going to be happy with them." But a second thought came to me almost as quickly. Why would you not want to do what it takes to be your best? The coach wanted us to run 6 miles for a reason. So here's the question. Would you change what you're doing if you knew the coach was watching? Would it be easier to get out the door for that 6-miler if the coach was living in your house? If so, why would you not choose to do it anyway? In the words of my mother, who seems smarter every day in my mind when I look back, "You're only hurting yourself." You don't need anyone but yourself to motivate you. If it helps to think about the coach watching every move, I suppose there's nothing wrong with that, but you should want to do it because it will make you better, or else the coach would not have asked you to do it. Today, Randy and I have both coached national championship caliber athletes. It seems to me the success we've had in running has a direct correlation to the past. Now, when it comes to our faith, our coach is a little different. He does see all that we do. that can be pretty motivating to stay away from the things we should not do. But there's a more profound reason to do God's will, not because we're afraid he will catch us if we don't, but because we want to please him. And if we take that a little further, being obedient to God will reap big benefits. We have all read the story of Job. He remained faithful to God when it was terribly difficult to do so. And what happened? He finished life with a double portion of everything. Job did what he did not because God was watching him, but because he knew the majesty of God and wanted to please him. Are you one of those people who say, if I only had someone to push me a little harder, I could do so much more? If so, get motivated by telling yourself that there's always honor and reward in doing what is right and good. Run because it will make you a better person physically and mentally. Do God's will because he is worthy. And when we do his will, he has a smile on his face. Now, don't you want to be the one responsible for that smile? Coming in our penultimate number two spot, our body is not a rental car. Why in the world do we treat our bodies like they're rental cars? Well, I'm going to make the case for why we should take better care of our bodies because God gave them to us and we should take care of them mainly because he told us to. This one's called Our Body is Not a Rental Car. After a run on a muddy trail, I'll usually change my shoes before I get into my truck and keep from spreading it around the interior. In the summer, I use a Runs Done cover over the seat to keep the sweat off my seat. I'll drive through the car wash once a week to keep it clean on the outside. Why do I do all these things? Because I want to take care of my truck. Now, what if the vehicle I was driving was a rental car? Would I change shoes, cover the seat, or drive through a car wash? Well, you know the answer to that. Why do I treat them differently? Well, one of them is mine, and I'm invested in it. I care about how long it's going to last. I like to take care of the things that are mine, especially new things. A rental car is not mine. Now, I do go out of my way to take care of the things I borrow from a friend, even though those things are not mine. Why? Because I care about my friends, and I appreciate that they let me borrow things. A few weeks ago, I borrowed a lawnmower from my next-door neighbor, and I returned it much cleaner than it was when I borrowed it. I am invested in the relationship between my neighbor and I. But a rental car feels different. I guess it's because you're paying for the privilege of borrowing it, maybe? I'm not sure why we seem to care so much less about a rental car, but we do. So what's my point? My point is that we often treat our bodies like they are rental vehicles rather than our own. This just doesn't make sense to me. So I thought about it, and this is what I think might be happening. Have you ever had something that doesn't work properly and is the source of much frustration because you spend as much time fixing problems as you do using that thing? For me, it was my lawnmower. For you, it may be a computer, a watch, or maybe even your car. You're so tired of the problems that you just don't feel like taking care of it. So you act like a child and do what you know on the inside you shouldn't do. You treat it like a rental. That's what we do with our bodies. We treat them like they're a rental because we're simply not satisfied with the way it has performed over the years. But let's go back to my lawnmower one more time. You see, I treated that lawnmower poorly because I had a lot of trouble with it. But one day, I decided to take better care of it. I replaced some worn parts, cleaned it every time I used it, and generally took better care of it. And I bet you're thinking that I'm going to tell you that it suddenly became reliable. But it didn't. But you know what did change? My attitude towards my lawnmower. I appreciated it much more than I ever had. And after taking good care of it, it's worth more money today than it was when I bought it years ago. Is it perfect? Far from it. But it gets the job done, and I'm not frustrated all the time. You may not find taking care of your body results in Vogue or men's health cover shoots, but you will appreciate that you have a lot. You will appreciate what you have a lot more. And let's face it, that body you don't care about is what God gave you. For that fact alone, we should take care of our bodies. The Bible actually tells us that we should. It calls our body a temple. Whether we want to admit it or not, we are invested in our bodies. And being disgusted with what we see in the mirror is not a good way to treat them. God gave each of us things to take care of. I have a terrible memory. It's the source of much frustration for me. But I came to the realization a few years ago that God made me that way. I can be frustrated with it, or I can choose to realize that because my memory is so poor, I don't tend to hold anything against people around me because I can't remember what happened. I'm only half kidding here. I have come to realize that a poor memory can be a blessing at times. And we need to realize that even if we don't like what we see in the mirror, there is a reason to appreciate it because God gave it to us. It really is that simple. Now, you may look at your body like it's a rental car or an old lawnmower, but I challenge you to change. The more you take care of your body, the more you will appreciate it. But more importantly, you'll be heeding God's advice. And in the end, I promise you, you will appreciate yourself for who God made you to be.
It's a great story, Dean. You know, but I take exception. I have been guilty of washing a rental car before.
Have you? It figures.
My number one story from last year was a no-brainer. This one was very easy for me. This one is called Ode to My All-Time Favorite Runner. This was a very emotional story for me. My dog, Flojo, had passed away this year. I loved watching Flojo run. She was so much. She just ran for the joy of it, and you could just see it on her face as she was doing it. And I wanted to honor her with this story called Ode to My All-Time Favorite Runner. My all-time favorite runner is someone you probably wouldn't expect. Steve Prefontaine was a beast, and he ran fearlessly, but he's not my favorite. I think Jim Ryan may have been the best middle-distance runner of all time, but not even the Master of the Mile is my favorite, despite the mile being my favorite distance. I really love the grit and determination of Alberto Salazar. His willingness to give all he had in the duel in the sun is legendary. But it's not him. I could go back farther to Emil Zatopek and his unbelievable feat of winning the 5K, 10K, and marathon in the 1952 Olympics. Even Runner's World dubbed him the greatest distance runner of all time. But even his amazing record isn't enough for me to consider him my favorite. On the women's side, there is, in my opinion, no one who did more for the sport of women's running than Joan Benoit Samuelson. I have always absolutely loved all 5 feet, 2 inches of her, but she's not my favorite. Even the more recent exploits of Faith Kipyegon and her barrier-breaking sub-350 1500 meter doesn't put her at the top, not even with that beautiful wide smile. No, my favorite runner of all time is not a woman at all, nor is it a man. No, my favorite runner is a girl. Her name is Flojo, and she is a dog. She lived with us for nearly 13 years, and I have never enjoyed watching anyone run more than her. She would bound like a gazelle through our yard, just for the fun of it. She showed me what it looks like to run with pure joy. When it snowed, she would dive into the snow and come out the other side, just like she did as I raked leaves. I wanted to be mad at her for messing up my leaves, but watching her have so much fun was intoxicating. Sometimes, she would chase something, like a bird, but more often, she wasn't running after anything more than unbridled joy. When Flojo ran, she ran fast. She was built like a greyhound or a whippet, and she ran like it. She ran uphill often, but she really loved to run downhill where she could run even faster. I wish I had been able to clock her to know how fast she ran. The speed was part of the beauty. Not that running slow is not beautiful, but when you combine the grace of perfect running form with the intensity of going fast, it's magic. And oh, so fun to watch. If you've ever watched a cheetah run on National Geographic show, you know what I mean. Flojo was named after the famous American sprinter Florence Griffith Joyner, known as Flojo, after we adopted her as a puppy from an animal shelter in Chattanooga. It was not hard to come up with a name after we saw how fast she could run. Naming her after the world record holder in the 100-meter dash just seemed appropriate. And like her namesake, Flojo was as beautiful to look at as she was enjoyable to watch run. She was a mutt, but she was one of the prettiest mutts you'll ever see. Flo, as we called her, left this world recently, and I miss her terribly. We don't know what happens to our pets when they pass away, but I sure do like the idea of Flo bounding through endless fields in heaven, never to lose her breath and have to rest. I sure would like to see her again someday. But if not, I'm so thankful for the 13 years I had with her here on earth. Run, Flo, and never stop.
Wow. What a great tribute, Dean. This is kind of different, but I know how much that dog meant to you.
Well, those are my top 10 Dean's thoughts from this year. You may have some that you liked better, and if you did, send me a line. Let me know which one you liked that I missed and didn't put on the list, because I would love to hear from you. Until next time, may God bless every step of every run and or walk. Go out there and shine your light.
For more information about Upward Running, visit upwardrunning.com. If you have questions about your salvation, click on the Peace with God tab. There is nothing more important. Thanks for joining us today.